Session number 9484.
Mr. Russell, rail 5, you were just saying you got to know somebody else then.
Well, just to correct what I said earlier about Togliatti, in fact, Togliatti was known in Spain as Alfredo. He was known in the international communist movement as Ercole, which was another pseudonym, but in Spain he was known as Alfredo, and I had met him first actually when I acted as an interpreter to Bill Rust at one meeting in Valencia of various communist representatives, and I acted as interpreter and got to know him there. And Guerra, well, I knew him in Spain as Pedro. And it was only years afterwards, on one occasion when I was in Budapest, long after World War II, when I was there on a job for the Daily Worker as a reporter, and passed by a bookshop, and there I saw an enormous picture of Pedro, the bloke I'd known as Pedro. And I said, who's that? Oh, I said, that's Guerra, the bridge builder, as he was known in Hungary at that time. But I knew he was. I don't know whether I even knew he was Hungarian. I knew Alfredo was Italian, of course. I knew that he was really Ercole.
And we should say Erno Guerra became Prime Minister, I think, of or
Well,
leader of
no,
the
he became
General
General
Secretary of the
Secretary of the
Communist Party.
Communist Party at the time of the 1956 events in Hungary, where I was sent, of course, as a reporter when I was correspondent in Moscow later.
What position did Guerra hold in Barcelona
And
then?
he was the Comintern advisor to the United Socialist Party of Catalonia, the PSUC, and which was had been formed in 36 for the unity between the Communist Party in Catalonia and the Socialist Party, and which had adhered and joined the Third International.
Can you tell me what he was like?
Oh, he was a grim person, I always thought. But to me personally, he was very friendly. And the only occasions that I had to have anything to do with him was on matters concerned with the Catalan radio broadcast that I did. He was the one who asked me to do it. There was some problems there with the. That the this Catalan the cat although the PUM had been defeated and made illegal after the events in Barcelona of May 37, the anarchy and many of the anarchists who agreed with the PUM were still had very strong influence in Barcelona and Catalonia in general, and it was felt that I was told that it was necessary that for me to do this, the English language broadcast and the Catalan broadcast, they were all on shortwave, whereas the central government broadcasts were on medium wave. I had very great doubts as to the value of broadcasting shortwave, which in those days would only be got by hams, really. And anyhow, I was told that it was Guerra who explained to me that, well, they were convinced that unless I took the job, that they would get an English person or an English-speaking person who was a supporter of the PUM or the anarchists. And so I agreed to do it, although it created, well, it meant an enormous extra amount of work for me. So I knew Guerra in that basis, but I knew.
Why do you say he was grim?
Well, he had a sort of grim appearance, you know. He didn't. I sort of would compare him with Togliatti, for instance. Well, Togliatti, you would crack a joke occasionally, even in the most difficult situations. Whereas with Guerra, who I didn't meet all that often, I had an impression that he didn't have the slightest sense of humour at all. Well, they were difficult times, and it's difficult to evaluate, I think, a sort of attitude of men there. I mean, you take, for example, the whole question of André Marty. Well, people say, and a lot of the many histories that have been written there about the Comintern and the international brigades, Marty is presented as some sort of inhuman monster, a butcher, a person who had no concern or interest in human beings or human lives at all. My experience of André Marty was completely untrue. The situation in Spain was hellish difficult. The International Brigade was confronted with the most horrendous problems, and they all did the best they could in the circumstances. Problems, of which I was not aware at the time, of the difficulties of grows up relations with the central government of the international brigades, the whole question of the relations with the Soviet representatives and the Soviet military advisors in Spain was a great difficulty, and I think these people tried to deal with them as best they could in very, very difficult circumstances. André Marty was a fierce disciplinarian, I think that can be said. And we felt at the time, not only myself, but other British comrades in the battalion, that if anything, there wasn't, what was more required was more, a greater disciplined force. And but anyhow, to get back to this business of the last days of Spain. After seeing this, I came back with Willie Forrest to Barcelona, and was in the party headquarters, and went up to see Togliatti, and I said, "Well, what do you see the situation?" Said, "We're going to do the best possible." But I said, "I've been out and there are no defences, you know." "Yes," he said, "that's the situation." "Well, so what's going to happen?" "Well," he said, "we shall fight as long as we can." And then when I mentioned this to Willie Forrest about what Springhall had said to me, stay at the last minute, he said, "Well, I've been in touch with my office, and they've told me that we don't want another Koestler affair," because they'd had Koestler, who had been taken prisoner by the Franco forces down south, was it in Malaga? And took a hell of a lot of work and top-level government intervention before Koestler was finally let out. And so Willie Forrest left, and I managed to get a lift out of Barcelona the day before, that's on the 25th of January, and with the man who was the Daily Herald correspondent at the time, a chap called Scott Watson. And that was really a horrendous journey to the frontier, because the roads, well, it was a sight that became all too familiar in World War II. Roads cluttered with refugees. And as you know, and it's still the case, the road from Barcelona to the French frontier goes most of the way right close to the sea. And there was at that time a railway going along nearby. Well, the road that night was being shelled by one of the fascist warships off the coast, and there came a point when we just couldn't advance any further, and we got out of the car, went further along, and then shells had hit the road, And it was just a mass of screaming people, donkeys and that. And we managed to get our way through. Scott Watson got married to a Spanish girl at that time and came along. We got to the border and found that the border had been closed. And the French had, on the French side, were Senegalese troops, white officers. Well, we tried to argue with the Senegalese, but there was no talking to them because it didn't seem that they understood French or anything. There was a bit of a row. The rain was pouring down, and we had on the Spanish side that all the people of all sorts, women, children, and no shelter at all, and a terrible state of refugees there. Well, after this row, a chap came out from a hut just on the actual border line, one of the white officers. And as soon as he heard that we were British, he apologised for, invited us into his hut. Said, well, we were free to go and no problem, but he had orders to close the border. Well, I went on there with Scott Watson. We went up to the village and there met up with Willie Forrest again and also Henry Buckley of the Daily Telegraph, whose book on the life and death of the Spanish Republic is very interesting. I got to know Henry Buckley quite well. He was a Catholic himself, and as the Daily Telegraph was more or less a right-winger in British terms and British conservative, but he had become absolutely supporter, 100% supporter of the Republican cause. And well, by that time, it was impossible to cover the war, from a reporter's point of view, from Spanish soil, because communication was very, very difficult, not impossible, telephone communication. I went in every day. Well, that's right. I didn't go with Scott Watson that same day from Barcelona. I'd got as far as Figueres with somebody else. And Figueres was a small town, but it was absolutely 10 times the population from refugees and all that. And I was there that day. The ministry, the journalists, foreign journalists, were sort of accredited to what was called the Subsecretariat of Propaganda, which is a part of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. They had set up an office in Figueres. And I was in there, and gone in and see what was happening. And the place, it was a complete defeat, retreat to the border. And while I was in the office, the place was being bombed. And a bomb fell actually on the building where I was. And when the dust cleared, I saw where it had come through the ceiling, and for some strange reason it sort of curved on it and went out on the side wall, fortunately for me, otherwise. And I rushed out and into the central square of Figueres, an absolute pandemonium, people rushing this way and that, and the planes coming over and machine gunning low, no defences whatever. And there was another occasion when I met Pasionaria. There was, at the height of the pandemonium, a group of people came out on a balcony from one of the buildings on the square, among them Pasionaria, and she started speaking and really stopped the panic. There was nothing you could do. I mean, there were no defences at all. And I had seen a number of occasions when she had a powerful personality. Anyhow, from Figueres, it was then that I met with Scott Watson and came to the border. And crossing the border, we saw the terrible treatment that was given to the Spanish refugees at that time. And really scandalous the way the French authorities behaved. But on the reporting side, I had had arrangement with Modesto, who was the commander mainly on the Spanish, General Modesto on the retreat, and met him to meet a dispatch rider at the border every day, and then went back into Spain, came out and phoned whatever story I had. Well, one day I'd met with Willie Forrest and Henry Buckley. We'd gone to Perpignan and came up in Henry Buckley's car the following day. The previous day we had been at the frontier, and there's that part of the frontier where one side of the road is Spanish, the other side is French. And as we came down the road from the village towards the actual border point, we could see there had been the previous day, I've forgotten what day it was, in February, was it? Yes, February, early February, where the Negrin, the Prime Minister, had held the last meeting of the government on Spanish soil, or on Catalonia, in a house there. We came down the next day, and as we approached, I could see that from top to bottom of this house, well, a small house, was the fascist flag. And I said, you know, the fascists have arrived. And Henry Buckley said, no, it just can't be. I said, look, and it was like a blow between the eyes of Henry. He just couldn't stand it anymore. He just went back. Although later on, Henry went back to Spain for Reuters, and presumably did such a good job there that he was awarded by Franco the Order Isabella la Cattolica. But still, I was very green as a journalist in those days, and I much appreciated the sort of help I got from particularly Willie Forrest and Henry Buckley. Well, Willie Forrest is still alive, as you know, and there's a great... great reporter. But Henry Buckley's book, because he had been in Spain before the coup, before the Franco coup, and his descriptions of the elections in February, which brought the Popular Front of power, really very, very good and very interesting. I don't think sufficient attention has been paid to his eyewitness account. It's referred to in Hugh Thomas and that, but not enough.
Going back to Togliatti, did you meet him very often?
No, naturally. I mean, he was, you know, far away, out of my sphere of acquaintance, really. I met him twice when there were meetings in Valencia, Barcelona, where I acted as interpreter for Bill Rust and Peter Kerrigan. Then this occasion when I went to see him when the last days of before Barcelona. And then the other occasion was, well, the end, when I, actually on that stretch of road, after Barcelona had fallen, and met him when he came out and was looking for one of the leaders of the French party. And I just put them in touch with each other. But he... I was never present at any of the sort of internal meetings of the Spanish party. The only occasions were there when I had business with him.
Whilst you were in Spain, did the issue which we hear so much about from Trotskyists and so on, about whether the revolution should be pushed forward or not, come up whilst you were there?
Well, remember that I was away from Spain during the time of the attempted putsch in Barcelona in May 37. I was in England from March, I think it was, March 30 to July 37. But, of course, when the trial took place of the PUM leaders, I was in Barcelona. And was not actually present at the trial, but by then the issue of the revolution had really become very academic. The rights and wrongs of that trial I don't think are clear to this day, certainly not clear to me. No doubt in my mind there wasn't then, and I haven't changed my view since then, that the PUM and the various anarchist groups who agreed with them, not all the anarchists by any means, were absolutely wrong in the idea that there could have been a revolution in the middle of the war at the time. But the treat them, and in the case of Andreas Nin, to be executed as fascists, that at the time, of course, I thought that the case was absolutely proved. But in the light of what we know now about the way in which such show trials were arranged, I have most serious doubts about it, and certainly, I say, it's not much use to the people involved, but it was a very bad way of dealing with the situation.
But in the International Brigade, did you and your comrades discuss this issue of revolution uprising on the war?
No. I mean, that to us there was no question but that the question had to be won. Now, of course, as I explained to you, my actual time in the brigade was really very brief, and so that the most of my time in Spain, although in fact I was in Spain longer than anybody because I was there right to the end, was in fact as a civilian, in very strange circumstances, but still. And most of the material that I used in the broadcast was, of course, came from official sources and consisted of interviews that had been obtained by the Spanish staff of the central broadcasting system, which were then made available to all the foreign language broadcasts. And when we dealt with the trial of the PUM people, that of course came naturally from official sources. And certainly I myself, when I saw what I saw in Spain, both during the brief time I was actually in the brigade and subsequently, I couldn't see that it was at all possible to carry out the revolution until the fascists had been defeated. And I came across some very strange activities on the part of the my particular case of anarchists. During the time that I was in Barcelona, after I was wounded, before going back with the casualty lists of the Jarama battle, this was February, March 37, I was asked to go and speak at a factory. Like all factories, it was a small factory. This had been taken over by the trade unions, by the CNT, the anarchist trade union. It was a small factory that was making enamelware, you know, pots and pans and chamber pots and that. But the machinery was such, it was rather primitive machinery, but was the government wanted to use it because it was stamping out things for shell cases and that. Now, I was asked by the party to go and, Spanish party, United Socialist Party of Catalonia, to go and speak to the International Brigade and that. When I got there, the people explained to me, well, you see, we are running this factory now, the trade union, CNT people, and what we are doing is to make sure that there is work for everybody. What they'd done is that they had a certain amount of raw material, continuing making pots and pans and chamber pots. And they, because raw material was difficult to come by, they'd cut down the number of hours until they were working only 30 hours a week, being paid full, all the workers were being paid for a full week's work, and they refused to accept to go over to carry, making shell cases with raw material that would have been supplied by the central government, of course, by the Ministry of Defence. And this was a sort of, for me, totally, I mean, cloud cuckoo land. Here were these people making me absolutely convinced that they were right. And nothing that I said made any difference either. I mean, I made what I thought was a powerful speech, and they listened very politely and just carried on as before.
You mentioned Peter Carrigan. Can you evaluate his role from what you saw of it?
I think Carrigan was one of the most outstanding comrades in Spain. He was a great, was he a comrade who had a certain amount of military experience. Strangely enough, as I discovered there, he had been in the Royal Scots too. I'd done my attachment to the Royal Scots, and he had been in the Royal Scots as a young lad after World War I, when he was about 18, had been in the Royal Scots and was in Palestine with them. And so had some experience, or more than most people experience, of the army, the British army. But then, of course, had done great work as a shop steward at the Parkhead Forge and in Scotland. And he, because of his experience with in the working class movement and his activities on the Hunger March and organising there on the Scottish contingent and the big Hunger March there to London, he had a feel for working with men which was... I can't think of any other comrade who was so successful as Peter Carrigan was. Certainly much more successful than Bill Rust, in that I always felt that Bill Rust has far too sort of bureaucratic attitude to people. Now, I know that this view of mine of Carrigan is not shared by many people who consider that Carrigan was much was a real sort of typical party bureaucrat. It certainly was not in my experience. And when he became had the job of being correspondent, something he'd never done before, or since, really showed that he was a man of not only great courage, but could take to another job and also accepted suggestions and criticism, what I found. But certainly as a man of great courage, personal courage, and there was that famous occasion during the Ebro battle when I was with him, and he was held up at the river when there was bombing taking place. And he was fed up with waiting and dived in. It was about halfway across when the fascist bombers came over. And we were shouting at Peter. And he looked up and saw them and just carried... Well, it was the only one thing to do, just to finish swimming and cross the other side. Well, his clothes were this side. And it was a couple of hours before we put up the pontoon bridge again after the bombers had gone, and went across and found Peter on the other side in a cave there, stark naked, and we got his clothes. And he was also had a sense of humour. There again, my experience of him differs, I know, very much from other people who claim that he had no sense of humour, that he was a humourless person. But I didn't find him that way. And he also, while was a great internationalist, on the two occasions when I acted as interpreter